Hello, everybody. This is Matthew Galt, the host of Cyber. I'm just going to briefly introduce what you're about to hear. All this past week, we did nothing but talk about Dune on Cyber. If you've noticed, there's quite a few episodes that have come out of that. We recorded them live, as we are doing now, on Motherboard's Twitch channel, which is at twitch.tv/MotherboardTV. Go there to follow us, and you can watch Cyber be recorded live from now on. It'll be uploaded as a podcast soon after. But going forward, we are recording Motherboard's Cyber podcast live, direct to Twitch. I will see you there. Without further ado, here's the last conversation we have about Dune.
This is our very, very last episode of Motherboard Does Dune. Motherboard, Dune, Dune. Again, I saved it for last, right now. And we have, I think, a really great cast of folks to round us out and take us home here. We have Tim Marchman, returning champion from every single other episode. I think it's just me and you have been the only two, I think, steady presences in this entire Arakeen endeavor here. And we have Ed Ongwiso Jr., Motherboard staff writer and Dune head. And then our special, and Matt Galt is behind the boards today, also a Motherboarder and Dune extraordinaire. And we have two special guests, Kelsey Atherton, the author of Wars of Future Past, a fantastic newsletter about exactly what that title describes. And we have Daniel Immerwahr, the historian of Empire and noted Dune scholar, which we've referenced your work, if you haven't heard, throughout the entire series here and there. So anyone who's, you know, listened to this whole thing, this will be kind of satisfyingly, I hope, drawing it to a close, because today our topic will be war and geopolitics of Dune, and sort of what was going on when Herbert was writing this, and how it really emanated in the decades following. Yes, Matthew, we can hear your clacking keyboard. But you know, it's kind of charming. Maybe it's like somebody who's doing the controls on a harvester or something. So, to kick things off, as is our ritual, has everyone seen the movie? Our newcomers especially.
Yeah.
And your thoughts as a historian and Dune scholar, Daniel? What do you think?
Oh, I fucking loved it. I was just in heaven. It was so good. It doesn't even matter. I mean, there's these great moments when he messes with the plot and you're just like, yeah, it works. It works so well. It's so visually incredible. The music is extraordinary. And, you know, it has this way of kind of incepting your own sense. Like I've been thinking about Dune and the characters of Dune and Duncan Idaho and all that kind of stuff. Jason Momoa is my Duncan Idaho. That's how he looks now. And so that's kind of what you want in a movie like that. I thought it was terrific.
Nice. Kelsey?
Yeah, I think it's a triumph at making the world feel lived in and real, which is a tall ask for here is science fiction without any computers. And they do an amazing job of carrying that out, of leaving out voiceover. The time that it takes to set up everything, where you don't even get really to like events of the book until an hour or so in, is well spent. I think it really grounds the universe, and it borrows a lot from like how do we make this feel as meaningful and haunting when the material is rich in many ways, but it's the book has its moments of being a hurdle to get through or to it throws you in the deep end, and this doesn't. I really like that.
Nice. Now, Matt, what did you think? Can you beam in as a disembodied voice?
Can I beam in as the disembodied voice here?
Yeah.
So I should have fixed the audio. There were some audio issues in the chat, if someone will tell me. I believe everyone should be able to hear me now. Cool. Yeah. Thank you, Handy Andy. I loved the movie. I thought it was fantastic. To give me my Dune bona fides, I've only read the first book. I've seen the Lynch movie, and I've now seen this movie. And to me, the most important thing about Dune is that it is a story about a person that has a vision of their future, which is rampaging across the universe, committing genocide at a galactic level, and says, let's do it. And they captured that in the film. And so I think, like,
You're going to love the next three books.
I'm excited. I was kind of one of those people who was like, I don't need to read the rest of them. But now after watching the movie, I'm kind of like, I kind of want to read the rest of these now. I'm very interested. So I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. I already liked him. I think Blade Runner is better. Blade Runner 2049 is better than Blade Runner personally for me. So I was already bought in. Sorry.
Wow, that's spicy.
Sorry, it's just the truth. Ridley Scott doesn't understand the films that he makes, and he accidentally makes good ones now and then, but mostly they're bad. Sorry.
That is extremely zesty. I could not disagree more on Blade. The Ridley Scott thing is maybe, but he's made enough good ones where it's like, okay, sometime, maybe in a certain point. I mean, maybe it's like the Frank Herbert effect, right? Like, Frank Herbert, like, clearly was out of his mind all over the place, and, like, he landed on one book, at least, where everything aligned. Like, Dune 1, everything works. It's epic, it's exciting, it's got all the ideas packed in. The rest of them have, like, shades of it, and, you know, but it does seem scattershot. Like, you know, we've mentioned before how you've got, like, a giant talking sentient worm being, like, ruling the galaxy by, like, book 4. So it's like...
Now that just makes me want to read it more. Actually.
Yeah, so I respond to that by saying, like, maybe, like, I don't... I we don't need to talk about Ridley Scott or Blade Runner, I think, any more than that. But your point is taken. I agree. But I did not like the last Blade Runner, but I did like this Dune. And now we know that we're getting a sequel, and we are sort of for sure going to venture further into this territory.
A sequel, an HBO TV show about the Bene Gesserit, and he's already talking about doing the third book.
Yeah.
Perfect. Good.
Yeah. And as we were discussing before we went live, obviously they're going to spin this IP out into every format imaginable, which is delightful. I can't wait to play like a Bethesda Dune game. You know, I'm ready for everything.
You could play the Jihad in the Butlerian Jihad. That would be great.
Yeah. It will. It will absolutely. I think we all knew after the weekend, it was only after it got 40 million, after, like, not only that, but, like, it also, I don't know if it was, like, quite Squid Game level fervor where, like, everybody was talking about it, but it was pretty high. It has, like, the stars, it had its own online meme with the Dune thing, it had, like, all, everything was aligned. And I'm really curious, and we talked briefly about this in one other stream, but I'm curious as to what's going on behind the scenes, because it seems like there's maybe some bad blood between Denis and, like, the studios, because just the fact that they didn't immediately greenlight it, the fact that he was mad that they simulcast it with the HBO thing, the fact that, like, there was, like, a little more, like, usually you get a blockbuster and it's, like, immediate. It's like, yes, we're giving you, we understand you, the people, we're giving you everything you want.
I am so fucking done with these directors. It's been a year and a half. Like, at some point, they have to realize there's plague going around and, you know, no, it's not going away. And they, like, I get how much they want people to see it on 60-story tall screens, but like they need to stop with this petulant whining. That seems to be something you talk to your buddies about over a drink, as opposed to going on about it at length and incessantly in every interview you give. This is just a pet peeve of mine. Like, I know where they're coming from, but it's a strange thing.
I agree with you on that. But I will say also, like, seeing it in theaters was very different from seeing it at my home. You know, yeah. The visuals are alone, but also the voice, the way the voice rattles my fucking body in the theater was so good. Yes. That was.
I can't wait to see it there, because, like, Daniel was talking about the sound design. I've seen it twice at home now, and I don't have, like, a super fancy setup or anything. But the second time, one of the things that really stuck out to me the most was the music and the sound design and, like, I'm really looking forward to having that wash all over me. One of the things I really liked about Blade Runner 2049 was same, and just, you know, it rattling your teeth as the cars were flying over the post-apocalyptic cityscapes. So having that like physical experience with the sound is something I'm definitely looking forward to.
Yeah, I love, you know, Lynch had a good designs, but his voice is like Aaliyah. One of my favorite scenes in all of movie in cinema, where it's like Aaliyah, the kid, be like, get out of, no, it's the Reverend Mother being like, get out of my mind. And then Aaliyah's like, oh, not until you tell me. And that's it. That's the voice. But here it was just kind of shocking. It really does. It's really fucking unnerving. And no one spoiled that little trick that they did in their reviews. And I was wondering what they were all talking about when they described the voice. Cause they're like, oh, it does it in a weird way. And I was like, oh, it's just going to distort it. Right. But yeah, so I can see on some level, if he's like a fanatic about Dune, why he would want everyone to be like, you have to see it. You have to see it in theater. But also, yeah.
So let me,
is whining.
Can I put this to the group then? Because I've been kind of watching this discourse build over the past week. I've been kind of fascinated to see this story like take root and people get really invested in it and interested in it. And I also noted that, you know, Apple right now is airing its adaptation of the Foundation trilogy, which is also a story about a guy who has a prescient vision of what the next 1,000 years are going to be like amidst a collapsing empire. And I have to ask, why are these particular stories resonating right now?
Is Foundation resonating?
Yeah, that's
fair enough. That's, somebody's all right. Fair enough. Okay, so someone's making Foundation, but the darkest version of it, right? The Dune version. That's the one that's really resonating with people.
Yeah.
Right.
I think in part. Go ahead, Daniel.
No, I was just going to say, there's a really cool sci-fi article from the 1980s by this guy named John Grigsby, where he points out something that, you know, I think maybe some of us had vaguely sensed. Dune is a response to Foundation. It's the same plot, right? It's the family goes out, or not the family, but his group goes out to the edge of the galaxy while the empire is declining, and there's this chance for rejuvenation. Except, and you know, prescience is a huge part of it. And then it turns out to be entirely different, right? Foundation is about how people who foresee things are correct and everyone who screws it up just needs to be, you know, got in line. It's very much a like CIA view of, you know, superintending world affairs kind of thing. And Frank Herbert, who's writing in the Vietnam era, has a very different take. And, you know, as you get into the Dune saga, you end up with Paul, who's the kind of Harry Seldon of the Dune universe, blind and walking around in the desert, having like, you know, genocided billions of people. And that, you know, so the argument is that these two things are responding to each other. And I would totally agree that right now Dune feels like it strikes all the chords, and Foundation, I mean, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is a response to Marvel, honestly. I mean, I'm a big Marvel fan. I've seen pretty much all the movies. I love them for what they are. I'm not someone who's hating on them, but they're getting really fucking samey. And they've been on top for a really long time now. And something that you can sink your teeth more into, that has some subtext, that, you know, is still in the same broad genre. I think people are ready for that. I'm excited to see what other projects people can do. Like, if you want to talk about a book written by a lunatic with incredibly objectionable ideas that is really ripe for a big movie adaptation, like The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Would be, that could be a really fun property to see adapted. There are a lot of things.
We have not even Ursula begun to explore the perversions of Robert Heinlein.
Right, the Heinlein verse. Yeah, those are interesting points. Especially because like we're seeing them lined up almost like Dune has like emerged at like in a viewing, like anyone who has started watching Foundation can now view Dune as a response to that, and it's not complete, it's only the first half. But the other like contender, I've been thinking about this too, and I've got like a half-baked take bouncing around my skull about like why Apple dumped, obviously, like the director was on record saying that he spent more on most movies on like a couple episodes of Foundation than most of the movies that he does. It's the huge budget. They obviously took a huge swing, and like nobody's talking about Foundation. Like Squid Game came out 2 weeks later, and then it's off the map, and it's all about sort of a critiques of capitalism and like living in this sort of crushing moment. And then Dune comes along and undermines that sort of Harry Seldon thing. So I do think that there's maybe some configuration where like Harry Seldon is the hero that sort of neoliberalism wants, right? The wise man who says like, follow all the rules incrementally and slowly but surely we will build a foundation on which to have a equitable and good global. It will take, you know, I can't tell you how long it'll take like hundreds of thousands of years. Like, you will never live to see it, but just trust me, like, the world is slowly getting better.
That's, I think, what makes Dune in part resonate so much for the moment is especially, and I think sort of the genius of taking so much time to set up the events and then to also like show what is it that the Atreides are being called to do? What is the system? What is this universe? And like there's factors we know, like there's lots of machinations all at once. But fundamentally, Dune is almost a story, or at least this part of Dune, it's a story of the Emperor coup-proofing himself against any challenge within the institutions of the universe as they're structured, right? Like the reason you pulled a Harkonnen off only to invite them back is to utterly crush a charismatic rival who could, through politicking, unite the Landsraad against the cruelties of the executive and break up things. And the Empire has settled on stagnation as its path forward. And so that's sort of it's a game you play. It's a thing we see in complex systems of statelets and concert systems, is how do you crush anyone who is trying to break an established status quo that benefits the already powerful? And not that like the Atreides are obviously a part of the system, but I think it's really telling that like Leto plays by the rules and tries to play by them very well and just absolutely massacred. And so when you have there's that moment where Paul is trying to in the ecological station start maneuvering in the same way, and Liet says, like, you can't do this. You are a child on the run. And that's sort of where we see the shift from what does it take to break out of a flawed, stagnant world, and then if there's a flawed, stagnant world that's resonating, well, that's because that's where we're at right now.
Right, and not only a flawed... Yeah, exactly. And not only a flawed, stagnant world, but one sort of governed by the, you know, the inertia of these systems that are so vast. And we've talked a little bit in a previous book, and I'm really curious to hear yours and Daniel's and Ed's thoughts about this, about to the extent that it comes across that like that. You know, in the books, it's very clearly sort of there's like a hierarchy of sort of interests that are somewhat interlocking, but some have more power than others. And maybe Chome being like the stand-in for OPEC and this and like the trade guild has maybe the most power that the emperor has to kind of adhere to. And then there's the emperor, and then there's the noble houses. But how much sense in the film do we get that all of these sort of, you know, generational institutions and oppressors are sort of you know, really kind of immutably moving the action and setting the stage here. Daniel.
Oh, I was just, yeah, sure. I mean, sure. Look, they have to mute it, right? You cannot do like a deep dive into Chome politics in the film. It's just going to kill it. I mean, I would be up for it, but no one else would be. I thought it was handled really well, where you see there's an imperial reshuffling, but you get it from the Fremen perspective, you get it from Chani's perspective, and she's like, I wonder who our next oppressors will be. And you're like, that's all you really need to get. Like, there's this imperial chessboard that goes around, that, you know, games are being played, and something is changing, and it kind of matters for the Atreides, but for the Fremen, it almost doesn't matter at all. And you know, since the film is ultimately going to, like, suck you into the Fremen world, like, it's a journey from the Atreides world to the Fremen world, I think that does it very, very nicely and concisely.
Yeah, you know, I think it's also like in the book, he sets up a lot of time to try to get you into that mode of thinking Atreides good, Harkonnen bad, noble, decadent, right? And it's only in the, once they're really like in the desert, or that you start to see, one, you were like, what's actually going to happen with Paul? But that also that sort of framing didn't really make much sense. And I think like you said, it was really good to just kind of focus on the Fremen and then also show a little bit of the of Leto being trying to be like, we can do it better, you know, we just gotta fix the machines and I gotta care for my workers and if things will be good and ignoring that fundamentally or obscuring the fact that like he views the Fremen. He says he wants to work with them, but he also views them as a pawn in the larger scheme to try to like contain and challenge the Emperor. That is hinted at a few times in the dialogue they have in the movie, and also that he doesn't seem to understand the nature of the spice operation and that it is like an extractive, impressive process that the Fremen resist, and that he can say he's going to be different, you know, and he can say he's going to be nicer, but there's still going to be conflict and tension there.
Yeah, we've discussed this briefly previously in some of our conversations, but I've seen some criticism that Duke Leto is a bit wooden and virtuous and good, and that's just not what I saw in the movie. I mean, the way he wants to instrumentally use the Fremen for his own purposes, the way he doesn't seriously engage with their culture in any way past not having Stilgar decapitated for spitting on his table. Does not paint a flattering picture of him or how he approaches the political economy of
desert
this world.
Power, right? He just like literally just keeps saying desert power.
Like they're a unit to be summoned in an RTS game, right?
Yeah, it's like a trap card in Yu-Gi-Oh! Yeah.
And so with desert power, I think it's also important that he is obviously right, like Chom is our OPEC stand-in. But Desert Power, he's writing at a time of post-colonial like struggle. There's a very clear context. Hopefully got the name right. I think Khaldun Khalil was citing. It's a lot of like you can see the parallels to the Algerian War of Independence and some of the phrasing and names. There's a whole lot of like what we have is we see Leto. We see Leto as an enlightened sort of colonist, but he's an enlightened colonist. He's looking to Desert Power. And the ultimate struggle, and certainly we see this explained by Leah, and hopefully we get a lot more of it in part two, and we should, it's in the text, about like what desert sovereignty is, what it is for the Fremen to be sovereign over their own world, because we have barely any, like the Fremen are part of the world, and we know that they either exist in independent communities or in some sort of debased form where they're like begging for water on the streets of Arakeen. And he's writing in this context, and also like fully aware of like the Lawrence of Arabia narrative of an empire goes in, it turns to the people in the desert, it sees them as a tool for power, it makes promises it cannot keep, and then the people are sold out at the end. That's intentionally in the narrative because that's what he's responding to. That's a big part of it is understanding that desert power is a phrase for exploitation. It acknowledges the strength, but it's not really like these are people with a different understanding of the world.
Can I ask a lore question? Are the Fremen, are the humans that began on that planet? Where did they come from?
Oh, that's a good question.
They're off world.
They are off.
They're all humans. They're all humans. These are all Earth people. And there is a gentle explanation of the backstory in some of the later novels about how the Fremen got there, but they were not, I mean, they're kind of indigenous in a kind of symbolic sense, but,
right.
But they're all from Earth.
Right. Like, but long, long time ago.
Yeah, long
time
ago.
Diaspora. Yeah. For
traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Speaking of lore, we're here to discuss, among other things, geopolitics, and I wanted to toss out something that does not appear to be in the movie so far. It does play a reasonably prominent role in the books, which is atomics. There is a kind of structure of mutually assured destruction among the different houses. There's a vast and serious taboo on the use of weapons, and in a lot of ways, the big houses are defined by their possession. I'm not sure of this, but I think that they may be the only entities allowed to hold them. And they have, you know, these weapons have effects on the shields that are used. It's one of those things that's lurking there in the background, but that makes a lot of sense of the way warfare is fought and the way power is exercised. That was left out. So I'm curious for the room, if anybody has thoughts on that, what the omission does, and, you know, whether it's a big deal. It's one of those details that I missed. I thought it would have taken two lines of dialogue and clarified some of the political jostling and the military structure of this universe.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you can always tell when a sci-fi story was written or produced by how it deals with nuclear weapons. It tells you a lot about the era in which the work was written in. And I think that the fact that they are completely absent from the film in any way is an economy of making a movie kind of thing, but also very telling about the way we think about nuclear weapons right now. Sorry, that's my hot take on that.
Yeah.
I was going to say they also
kind of vacated a lot of the tech or a lot of the discussions of tech, right? They don't talk about the Butlerian Jihad. They don't talk about, as we talked about in one episode, how the absence of computers leads to all these like factions that deal with engineering humans. They don't talk about like the reason why the shields are used and why lasers aren't used, even though that's like the depiction in most sci-fi, right? Because the lasers, if you hit them with the shields, they blow up the entire area. And so they just do hand-to-hand combat. Instead, I think, like, part of me feels like it was just shot off because the story he's crafting, it may not alter the geopolitics of it, right? If he's not going to end up telling the larger story of the Dune universe and instead tell that initial story of Paul, you know, his journey into the world of the Fremen, his attempt to usurp the Emperor, is years after that, then they may not focus too much on that fundamental element of the geopolitics, and instead kind of focus on like Paul becoming worshipped as a god and what that actually does to the empire, the replication of, you know, imperialism across his dominion, instead of like these are how the houses balance off against one another because he smashes the system essentially.
Moon yeah. RPGs in the chat says that yes, only the great houses have atomics. To answer that
Daniel,
question,
yeah, I'm interested to hear your context here, Daniel, as a historian of Empire.
Yeah, there's a version of Dune where it starts out. They're like, there are various warring houses, and each of them has a cache of atomic weapons, and you're like, this is the dragons in Game of Thrones. Like this, you know, those are Chekhov's atomic weapons. Those are going to go off in the third act. Of course, right? Because like these are fights between these houses and they all have atomic weapons. And that's not what happens at all. And in fact, that kind of mutually assured destruction standoff becomes, which is both at the level of atomic weapons, but then lower at the level of guns because they have all these shields, becomes a way for Frank Herbert to get us into a kind of medievally sort of vibe where it's all daggers and poison is how people do each other. But B, I mean, just, you know, in his world, to get this away from being a great power competition and to get us into anti-colonial rebellions. So it's about people with low tech. It's not the Fremen or no tech. They have the steel suits and all that kind of stuff. But the way to win a war is not by, like, no one cares how many atomics you have. It all ultimately comes down to this kind of indigenous or colonized, you know, people who have a kind of different relationship to technology and they win. And I think Frank Herbert, I mean, this is not a Cold War. Frank Herbert is deeply interested in the Cold War, and he writes a Cold War novel that doesn't get published earlier than this. And he writes another one that does get published earlier than this, but this is not a Soviet Union versus US Cold War. This is very much the like Algerian War of Independence. This is an anti-colonial war kind of vibe that we're getting.
It's really, really interesting. I haven't really thought of that like element of Dune taking the four. It really doesn't, but pretty much everybody has like, I guess the sense of mutually assured destruction is so like is so atomized, and it's so like everybody lives with it. So, I mean, are they all, because everybody has these shields that goes into battle, and if somebody uses the, you know, it shoots a laser at them, it could set off a chain reaction, right? That's kind of the explanation that's given. It's not really returned to a lot, but it's like, right? Like, it's just like, this is the reality of the world. Someone pulls the wrong trigger, and it could happen in like a hand-to-hand combat situation almost. Someone like brings a gun to a knife fight, it could like completely ruin society. So that gives you a sense to Matt, that was an interesting point about how different eras like process this threat of nuclear destruction. But here it's like every single soldier's carrying around with that, or at least aware of it on some level. Maybe they've forgotten about it because it's so rote.
Yeah, they never like, use it.
They never use it because it's terrifying.
It also reminds me, sorry, Kelsey, one more. This is just on my mind because I just read Foundation, and again, to think of them kind of in conversation with each other, written in the 40s and 50s, like the way Asimov talks about nuclear stuff as basically like a miracle cure for everything, right? And like the back end of all the great technologies, all this atomic power is again, really interesting to contrast with where we get to just a couple, you know, two decades later when Dune comes out. Sorry, Kelsey.
So I think one of the things that really, really has struck me, and this might just be because I have The Verge by Patrick Wyman fresh on my mind, but something that we see with the houses and we see this sort of concert power system is what counts for military skill is professionalism. It's what sets the Atreides apart from the Harkonnens. It's what makes the Sardaukar so much better and why you would go to the Emperor. What does the Emperor have control over if the Emperor doesn't directly control Spice? The Emperor controls an incredibly powerful mercenary unit that he dispatches or he contracts out. And what makes them powerful is discipline and cultist ritual and all those very heightened training and warrior culture things. But specifically, they're a well-equipped, well-supplied professional military that ends up becoming a component of other militaries. It's how you tip a scale. And we see this. We saw this with, like, this is when, like, the emergence of, like, professional armies before they were national armies. You'd have, like, professional mercenary bands that would contract between the various kingdoms, really, of Europe in the 15th and 16th century. And so we have that layer, right? That's how you get your – how do you have many powers who don't fight total wars against each other? You have that sort of professional army doing this melee combat, and then you also have it layered on top of colonial war. And I think they should have thrown in a line about the Butlerian Jihad. They should have mentioned something. It feels a little absent. But we see its effects where I think the key moment for me – which struck this time that I hadn't seen before or really hadn't said in before, is that the Hunter Seeker, right, that little drone that comes out to kill Paul, has a pilot who had to live in a hole in a wall for 6 weeks in order to do it. And this is obviously like my day job beat is all about drones and things, but specifically that you need to have a remote pilot that close because it's not just illegal, but it's verboten. It's culturally taboo to have a computer that could do it all remotely anyway, really gives a texture to the world and why you need this kind of visceral proximity of people in conflict.
I agree. And I think one of the things that's really well done in the book and well done in the movie is just following through the logical extensions of some of the stuff that you do have. These are tiny, tiny armies. You know, the Atreides legions that are supposed to be so ominous. It's a few, you know, it's like a couple of thousand guys, which is, I don't know if realistic's the word I want to use there, but you know, it's in line with medieval and Renaissance combat in a broad sense. And it leads to these things like the Sardaukar's legion annihilating offensive is basically just firing a few rockets, something you can do without computers. You know, you can just target those and drop them on these guys. And it really sets up the Fremen wave of conquest because, you know, they are fighting an anti-colonial war and they're tapping their entire population. They're going to have, you know, their people of military age out sweeping across the universe when these other houses have, you know, if the Atreides are, you know, potentially in a position to pitch over the Emperor with their military power that, you know, consists of, you know, enough people to fill like a really big movie theater. having hundreds of thousands of Fremen bent on, you know, bent on their destruction makes a lot of sense.
I have another lore question kind of in line with this, if we can. Is the Fremen population much greater than some of the populations of other planets? Because I was kind of struck when they talk about that in the movie about how just how many people there are living on this planet that you just don't know about, right? Tens of thousands of people underneath the surface of this place. And then I was, you know, watching it, I was thinking, like, what is life like for, quote unquote, a normal person on any of these other planets that is not Dune? Is there even like what we would think of as like a serf or a merchant or anything in this universe at all?
That's one of the things that we've talked about as being especially kind of a, I mean, it's not really gotten into much in the books. We're pretty preoccupied with Dune, but especially in the movie, it's just kind of, you're either one of the troops or you are a Fremen or you're off world plotting to, or you're a Sardaukar. Like we don't ever get a good snapshot of like daily life, of like what this whole world, something that a film like Star Wars did a lot, you know, you can kind of construct how like the basic sort of interactions between people or the economy would work. This is very much kind of, you're moving from the military to the fortress, you know, castle in whatever it is looming over Arrakeen, and then you're sort of dispersed from it.
Because it's like that military only, then the only other kind of look into non-military life is like underworld, you know, like where there's implications when they meet the Fremen in the desert, like, oh, you can get people off world, where it's like, okay, where if you can do that, you have to do that without the Spacing Guild, which runs interstellar commerce and trade. So it's like some, you know.
Yeah. Somewhere. And same with the other world, like Caladan, the Atreides home planet, pretty much exists solely as like a watery surface for Paul to stare out meaningfully over, like when he's contemplating leaving. Like, we don't ever see anything about what those worlds look like. I do think that's kind of a shortcoming, at least because it's fun to see it, right? Like, it kind of brings you into the movie more into the world when you can kind of at least commune with that aspect of it. We kind of get these big brutalist architecture scenes where there's like a few people in the corner. I mean, it looks great.
I loved it so much.
It's absolutely beautiful film.
It does, though, I think, communicate like the feudal nature, too, right? Because it's like they're just living in their castles and fortresses. They have no idea what the life is for any person outside their family and their
troops. That's a good point. Yeah.
And they mentioned, too, right, that it's not like the Caladan are all just pure loyalty to it. Because if you wouldn't specify that you rule Caladan by air power and sea power if you didn't have a reason to use that against someone there. There's nothing more in that, and I encourage everyone to never read the Dune prequel books, which get into it. But there's certainly a line there, right, that these are feudal holdings almost, right? These are feudal holdings that are passed around, and so the houses have a relation to power there and to subjects, but it's not like this is like the Caladan nation state is Atreides.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think this is actually a pretty good segue to ask you, Daniel, a little bit about, because again, we've kind of hinted at your work and we've gestured at your work throughout this. If we could maybe take a step back now that we've kind of established some of these things about how the movie portrays these facets of empire and how it is in the books, could you give us sort of the Cliff's Notes version of you know what this foundation is built upon? Some of your work, I know you wrote a great article, a great journal article about this, and you have a great presentation that folks should check out on YouTube if you are interested in the long version. But Frank Herbert conjuring into being here?
I'll confess that this all came as a surprise to me. I'd read the first Dune novel, I'd known it. And then I got asked by a magazine when we thought the movie was coming out a year ago, to, you know, do a Dune essay. I'm sure a lot of writers got that same request from different periodicals. And so I thought, all right, it's great. And I read about Empire, and I knew that Dune was a story about empires. And I was like, well, maybe there's something there. And, you know, I'm sure the answer is going to be about the Middle East, right? This is going to be a story about Middle Eastern politics, because Dune so visibly and aggressively conjures up Middle Eastern imagery, and Frank Herbert read a lot about Middle Eastern history, and, you know, Dune starts appearing just after Lawrence of Arabia drops and wins a bunch of Oscars. And then what I discovered was different and compelling, and I kind of fell down this very deep rabbit hole. And what it was that Frank Herbert, that stuff about the Middle East is true, and Chome is OPEC, and all that's correct. But at the same time, Frank Herbert he grew up and is writing often from Western Washington around the Olympic Peninsula. And there he is encountering and getting extraordinarily interested in indigenous politics, particularly politics that are from the Quileute people, which includes the Ho Band, which is now its own federally recognized tribe, and the Quileute Reservation, which is at Lapush. So when Frank Herbert is young, he's, according to his son, semi-adopted for 2 years by a Ho man who just kind of teaches him how to live off the land. And Frank Herbert, in a number of his works of fiction, including in the Stilgar-Paul relationship, replays that relationship, like younger off-worlder, older native man teaching him how to like live off the land. You just see that constantly. He's obsessed with this relationship. And then later in life, he befriends and becomes best friends with someone who becomes godfather to his son, Brian, a Quileute man named Howard Hansen, who at the same time as Herbert is writing Dune, Hansen is writing his own book called Twilight on the Thunderbird, which is now published and we have it. And you can get it on Amazon. And what it is it's a really kind of, it's an autoethnography account of what it is like to be Quileute at a time when the basis of Quileute life, or the ecological basis, is being decimated by logging. And the Quileute reservation at Lapush is being destroyed. And, you know, Frank Herbert had worked for one of the most rabid pro-logging senators, and he'd worked at a logging firm. But he was quite clearly affected by this. And the story that Howard Hansen told him about what industrial kind of production was doing to ecology and what that therefore was doing to culture, I think that really gets built into Dune. And even as Frank Herbert is writing Dune, you can kind of see him getting more and more kind of into Howard Hansen's understanding. And everyone says that Hansen was really important to Herbert as Herbert was writing Dune. And I think, I mean, you can also map the Fremen onto the Quileute, including the fact that Quileute is a whaling culture, and the Fremen are kind of organized their lives around these sort of sand whales, which are the sandworms.
Really interesting. Yeah. So, so not only like a rabid pro-business, but also a rabid, like very conservative, like yeah. Frank Herbert's politics.
Super right wing. Exactly right.
Yeah. Super right wing. He was a journalist as well. He was kind of, you know, all over the place. And how old was he? Was he when he was kind of, sort of taken under the wing or like really influenced by Hansen?
Well, when he first starts really getting into indigenous politics is when he's semi-adopted. It's when he's Paul Atreides' age. And then he's still pretty young when he and Hansen become best friends. And he kind of just leaps at Hansen, meets him at a piano recital, and just is like, you're going to be my friend, in a way that, I mean, it's just so unusual for white dudes at this time to be really deeply into indigenous culture. There's a moment when he's a journalist, when Frank Herbert gets assigned to review a Jimmy Stewart Western. And like the normal thing is like, it's a very exciting Western, you know, acting could have been better, whatever. And Frank Herbert's entire review is like, let's talk about native genocide. You know, it's like, it's just like paragraphs. He's like, movie is whatever, but like, can we acknowledge? And he's incredibly specific. He's like, here's the UN definition of genocide. Like, here's what happens to the Apache people. Like, he just goes on. And so this guy is, from a very early moment, touched by the wand and is quite clearly interested in figuring out how to make sense of indigenous people and indigenous life in the United States. And it's all exploding around him because, you know, I grew up in, you know, around Philadelphia, indigenous life was not in my face. You grew up around the Olympic Peninsula. It is.
Now, how much of this, when I raised this brief to another one of our guests, Mickey Kendall, our conversation was about race and eugenics and Dune and stuff. How much of this was like him, you know, his politic, he's like natural political mode in as much as we could describe something like that, was kind of like libertarian, anti-government. I think you write that like in as much as that he has like a political lodestar, it's just like government bad, government yeah. will corrupt. How much was he kind of fetishizing the culture of the Quileute and his friends there? Like, how much was he kind of saying like, this is like, I see this as like a noble thing that they're doing, standing up for that, and my affinity is because they are like pushing back against this encroaching government? Or
It's a really interesting moment in the 60s when there's a number of white countercultural figures who get really interested in Native culture. Stuart Brand, Ken Kesey, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it's unclear which way it's all going to point, right? To be anti-government in the 60s, well, that could be anti-Vietnam War. That could be a very left position. To be pro-Indigenous, that can point any number of ways. For Herbert, it's the kind of back to the land, arm yourself, distrust the government. He takes it in a martial and a very right-wing direction, and he's really anti-Kennedy, but actually pro-Nixon, and he's, you know, pro-Reagan later on. And, you know, Indigenous culture can point that way. There are a lot of Indigenous people who are incredibly hostile to the federal government for understandable reasons, and that can slot them into a libertarian politics as well. Does he fetishize Indigenous cultures? Yeah, I mean, it seems clear that he does, but also it's not a distant fetishization. He knows a lot, and as a reporter, he reports a lot on what's happening. He also, two times while he's writing the Dune franchise, he stops the Dune train to write a novel about Indigenous politics in Western Washington, which is insane. I mean, just imagine from a profit perspective, that's bonkers. He's got more Dune story in him, and he wants to write about a Red Power novel, which he does and which he publishes. It's unclear how much of this is a collaborative relationship between his Indigenous interlocutors and how much of it is a kind of appropriation exploitive relationship. There's an interesting moment when his best friend Howard Hansen reads the Red Power novel, which is called Soul Catcher, and says, you know, this is great. I mean, a lot of Quileute stuff is coming up in this novel, which it's about Quileute peoples. The ending is really like counter, like no Quileute person would ever do that thing that you have happening at the end. And Frank Herbert's like, yeah, well, whatever. So that's kind of one point of clear divergence where we know that he's hearing from Indigenous people that he's getting it wrong. And he's just like, you know, the story needs to come out the way I want it to come out. But it also is quite clear that he's doing ethnographic research. He's doing recordings. He's like learning Indigenous folklore and songs. And he's really into that. So it's not an incurious form of fetishization.
Just to throw some history here, too, that I think is interesting, is we forget in the late 1960s, early 70s, there was a pretty militant Indigenous peoples movement in this country, right, that occupied Alcatraz. Yeah, that occupied Alcatraz and occupied Mount Rushmore and led to, I think, depending on which historians you talk to, led to the creation of some federal bureaus and mandates that started to try to alleviate some of the material conditions on the reservations, right?
And when there's a version of there's so right after the Alcatraz occupation, there's an occupation of Fort Lawton, which is nearer to Herbert. He races to the scene to interview the leaders and to report on it. And he gets very excited. And one of the things they want to do with the occupied fort is set up an ecological demonstration project. Herbert loves this idea and then sets up one of his own on his own property. So he's very much, you know, sympathetic to, even if he doesn't fully accurately channel these Red Power politics of the 70s.
Really interesting.
I think it's also worth noting, and it's a really obvious point, but you know, Washington, the distance between Dune and Washington becoming a state isn't that much longer than the distance between us and Dune. That is one thing that kind of runs through you know, a lot of what Herbert's writing is that he does have this outsider's perspective in some ways. He's not fully committed to the, you know, he's not fully committed to America, I think, to concentrations of power. He doesn't write like somebody who's fully committed to that project. I don't think there's anything much that suggests he was. And so as right-wing as he was and as noxious as, you know, we're going to find his politics, I think in some ways he came by them a little honestly.
Interesting. I think also that's a distinguishing factor between him and like other right-wingers who like have this grab bag of ideas and believe that if only the United States adhered to their personal ideology, then it would rejuvenate itself and be a good type of empire. Whereas we have, it seems like, Frank Herbert insisting constantly that like it's a doomed project, no matter who is in the helm, no matter how charismatic they are, no matter how gentle or noble they claim to be, that it's still an empire,
which is a powerful insight and very much distinguishes him from someone like Heinlein, who I think his libertarianism was more of the, I want to be able to marry a bunch of women and like, not get taxed. Right. I don't think there's anything much more to it.
Than which is why, yeah, right. Hey, it's just funny also to see the interviews around the time where it's clear that's what's happening. And he's like, no, I don't think people should trust in rulers. And it's like, okay. Is that what God Emperor is about? Is that what Chapter House is about?
Yeah, I mean, there is a Dune story where Herbert is getting hounded by the IRS because he just won't pay his taxes. And the rate at which the later novels come out seemingly has a lot to do with his just, like, need to, like, pay taxes and the fact that he might be arrested if he doesn't.
It didn't work. It didn't get the IRS off his ass, but, he tried.
I just wanted to touch upon briefly, while we're talking about like the sort of parallel between like atomic power as the driver of like Foundation and Frank Herbert obviously puts spice instead as how you propel this universe. The uranium mining in the American Southwest, which is primarily done by and in Native communities, I don't know if it's ever directly addressed by him, but that's very much a here is an extracted resource controlled by the federal government used for purely or primarily distinctive purposes, but certainly for the reification of the state. Uranium is a state resource. It's not really a trade commodity. And that's happening in parallel. That's happening in parallel to a lot of this. And it certainly could see reflections of it in how in the relationship between extraction on Arrakis.
And when Frank Herbert, one of his early political projects is about extractive mining. He in the seabed, he works for a senator who's like very into that. And he's like, the United States has made new territorial claims to its seabed right outside of its shores. We should be mining the shit out of this. This is the new frontier. Fuck you, fish. And you can see that in the spice mining, right? You can see his first novel is about offshore oil drilling and the romance of offshore oil drilling, and those submarines kind of become the crawlers to do spice mining. But you can also see him get very uncomfortable with the whole project. So I think that resonance, Kelsey, is real.
Yeah, that's such a maybe. That's a I hadn't thought of that, Kelsey, either. That's such like a, maybe like the purest one of the purest analogs. And if you're just like looking to like map it directly onto, yeah, that's really good. And also, Tim, I hadn't considered that either. Because yeah, it was. I mean, we're talking. You know, 1965 was when Dune's coming out. It was like the Pacific Northwest was a very different place then, and it would have been a lot different to live there. Now, how about, you know, so that's kind of the Fremen piece and the indigenous piece and sort of like this anti-government. Now, what about, how does that, you know, what about these other sort of the feudal house kind of structure? Where is that in his mind? I mean, we've talked about Chome and how that's basically OPEC, but where is he coming up with this sort of, you know, it's House Atreides, House Harkonnen, and kind of governed by the Emperor loosely? Like, is there any analog to that, or did he just think that would be kind of cool?
I mean, my own sense is that he's such an anti-liberal. Right, like the welfare state liberalism is the thing that he is extremely uncomfortable with. And there's a moment in the later Dune novels where one of the characters that you're supposed to agree with says feudalism is the appropriate governing structure for a diverse galaxy. You're like, shit, man, just like say it. All right, that's. And when you think what's exciting about Frank Herbert and what makes him work now is like, if you're dissatisfied with liberalism or at least pessimistic about it, like Frank Herbert has got your back, but for any number of different reasons. And I think that feudalism. I mean, it's not a surprise that, you know, Parks and Rec doesn't really do it for us anymore. I mean, it's comforting, but it's like not our world. Like Game of Thrones is our fucking world. You know, we're just like, yes, that's how politics works. And I think Dune is much more in that, you know, Game of Thrones kind of vibe than, you know, and that seems appropriate at the moment.
Interesting. So it's like for like people resonate with worlds where it's anti-liberal and that it's saying, well, their sense of it as they're going is that it's saying liberalism has promised these things and has not delivered them, it's failed. Here's some other system where maybe you don't like it, but it could work better or it could be something more exciting, right?
And I don't think that means that we're all endorsing this, but right, I think it just means that imaginatively, like, we're like, yeah, it's time to think through non-liberal worlds, either because we're living through them and hating them, or because we're, you know, longing for them, or some version of that. But and I think that's why the Foundation, which is basically sort of a technocratic fantasy about control, yeah, seems like a weird thing for the moment.
Your great hero in Foundation is a mathematician.
Yeah.
Right.
This is a common theme too. Like Philip Dick plays with this a lot. The idea that after there's been some sort of great migration to Mars and other solar systems, you know, what's left is feudalism, that you have landed estates run by, you know, powerful individuals, and you know, the bulk of the population is serfs. And I think that is there are a couple of things going on there. One is that for somebody who's the style of libertarian, Herbert was, feudalism is the natural extension of their politics. I mean, we live in a world with Peter Thiel in it, you know, like we are tracking that way. It's an exaggeration. It's a caricature. It's a fictional lens on it, but there is a natural connection between those two things that I think he saw earlier than a lot of other people. And, you know, part of the reason you get that in science fiction is just, I think, because of who was writing it. You've got these kind of staunchly individualistic white guys who want to be left alone with their guns and harems and, you know, whatever it is exactly that they're into. They're going to orbit these ideas, and the better of them, like Herbert or Dick, are going to, you know, they're going to see a bit into the future. They're going to see the logical extrapolation of some of these ideas and play with it in ways that are disturbing and should be disturbing.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we are on track. I mean, if we get another Dune sequel and that one does a lot, maybe we are on track for what will be the perfect, like, cinematic cultural product of our time, which is like Timothée Chalamet doing genocide, like, across the galaxy.
Speaking of galactic characters doing genocide, Motherboard staff writer Gita Jackson is in the chat and asked a pretty good question. Do y'all think this is also why Dune is resonating with audience right now and Eternals is not? This new Marvel movie about, which none of us have seen, but I think we can all kind of figure out the arc of it, is about these superheroes that have been on Earth for generations and have watched all the bad stuff happen and have not stopped it.
Also, like, I also feel like that's an extension of the of that imagination thread that we're talking about, right? Like, where in a lot of the Marvel movies, it's reimagining conflicts where you know who's good and who's bad, and adding like a little zest that makes it complicated in the universe. Like, hey, one of the Eternals helped make the bomb, you know, or something like that, right? Versus a novel way of thinking about people's conflicting desires and wants and needs and the systems that they'll build out of it or resist in response to that. Like the latter is much more interesting than like, here's a bunch of like super models who have powers you can't imagine, and they did nothing while like billions of people have suffered all across human history.
It's like Foundation, right? It's like superhero. It's like, oh, we waited out, you know, and eventually just trust us, the super beings, and we will set things right eventually.
He's done the math. Yes.
Right.
When that movie is out. When that movie is out, the fans will mobilize and you know, it'll feel like it'll resonate. I don't know if it will, but it will feel like it.
The Eternal stands who've just been fucking waiting for this moment.
It's the Marvel people. There's Marvel stands is what it
look,
is.
I love Marvel. I've been getting so into specifically the X-Men comics and the reboot that they started 2 years ago, 3 years ago in Krakoa, and using that as a way to get more into the comics. And I love it. I've been watching all the movies, like one of you were talking about earlier, but like the fandom is something else. Really fucking something else.
When I saw
his weaponized robot army.
And so I don't even talk about liking the Marvel stuff because it's like I've seen them jump down people's throats if they like have a different interpretation of something in a way that, I mean, I guess goes with the territory for, you know, being online and having takes and such. But it's just like when, for example, when like we all joked about when that director was like, oh, well, you know, when two people love each other, they fuck. And so I'm going to have two of the superheroes fuck. And then a bunch of people were like, well, that's, I don't know if you didn't have to bring sex into this story about superhumans who don't exist in real life. You know, why do they have to fuck now?
Let's take this core part of being a human and just remove it from the story.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I do think those two things, Eternals and Dune, I think he was right. Like they play off each other a lot. It's, you know, it's, there's probably been a little bit of a backlash brewing on Marvel for a while. I don't think there's a lot you see when you look around the world that suggests that people with these awesome and incredible powers would, you know, use them for our collective benefit and steer history in the right direction. And so there's something very, Dune is, among other things, it's a superhero origin story. I mean, he has very specific powers that in a different context, you could put him in spandex with a logo on his chest and it would work just fine. And seeing that play out in a much scarier way and in a way that is not necessarily for the benefit of all is a good, you know, that's always a well-grounded view of things, but it's also specifically right now, it's kind of a revisionist look at how we look at our power fantasies. And that's something Herbert was playing with. I mean, one of the justifications for the genocide we keep talking about, it's very consistently stated that the visions of the future show that the alternative is worse. The alternative is the extinction of all mankind. And the choice, you know, it's a binary choice between the murder of however many billions and the extinction of the species. And, you know, that's when you start getting up into, you know, what would Superman do? What would this power
look like? This is a commentary, right? It's a commentary on a technocratic ordering of the world, right? In Foundation, a mathematician plots out the future of humanity, and in Dune, a mathematician stands there and calculates how much spice it costs to buy an F-35. This is sort of the difference of how far can you get with, like, just trusting the logic and existing rules of order as stated without understanding really the fallibility of human. And, like, there's a lot of fallibility. There's a lot of, like, propensity for evil. There's a lot of maneuvering. Leto knows he's going into a trap and is playing very well by the rules, but is still undone because he is not aware of the full breadth of the game against him. And it's much easier to read the news and assume, oh, people in power don't understand things, or if they do, they're maneuvering cynically, than it is to read the news and think, oh yeah, the people trusted with power are making good long-term decisions. And I think that's it. That's the core of the resonation. It's easy to feel when an empire crumbles and see the empire visible in that crumbling. And when it's going well, you don't really perceive it nearly as much.
Totally agree. Yeah.
I think that is actually probably a pretty good note to end this on. We've gone for just about an hour. With the crumbling empire and the crumbling response to Eternals and the rise of genocidal Timothée Chalamet.
It always comes back to infrastructure.
And genocidal Timothée Chalamet.
Yeah.
Spices and both.
That's right. Yes, so thanks everybody. This was really great. Really great note to end this exploration of all things Dune on. Special thanks to Tim for being my co-pilot, my rock amid the spice. And thank you to Ed and to Matt and to Kelsey and Daniel for dropping by today. If anyone else has any last thoughts on Dune, now's the time to utter them into the streams.
I just hope that someone somewhere who's close to Denis or will convince him he's got to do Children of Doom and then God Emperor of Doom and then Chapter House and then Heretic. So just go.
I completely agree with that. This looks like a man's life work to me for the rest of his life.
He just doesn't know it yet. He just doesn't know it. And Jason Momoa, I don't know what kind of skincare routine they'll get him on, but, you know, get on that.
Oh.
Well, they'll just clone Jason Momoa over and over again to keep having him play a cloned Duncan Idaho over and over again, right? That's how you do it.
Oh,
Well, we've positioned ourselves very well. Then we can all quit our day jobs and just become full-time Dune streamers.
Dunecasters?
Dunecasters. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, it's good.
Okay.
Maybe extras.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thanks to everyone for joining us.
Yeah. I'm gonna play some outro music. We're going to see how this goes.
Cool.
Look at that.
Ooh, yeah.
It worked.
That's good. Oh, yes. And these will all be available as podcasts, too. So
They are already hitting the Acast stream. This one will probably come out tomorrow because I'm very hungry and I haven't eaten lunch yet. So I've got other tasks to do. But tomorrow, this will be out as a podcast.
It's good.
It's good. Yeah.
All right.
Bye.
Goodbye, everyone. Thank you.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.